Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with presidential historian Jeremy Suri, author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. We'll also hear from Shannon Svetanovich, who's the executive director of YMCA Educational Services, about ways you can make a difference in September, which is National Literacy Month. Jeremy Suri is a distinguished professor of history who holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas. He will be presenting his new and important book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, at the National World War II Museum. Jeremy Suri, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm so glad to meet you. This is such a fascinating book. But I have to say, if any little girl out there is thinking of growing up and becoming president, she'd better read this first, because it really is an impossible job.
It really is, and I have a daughter, and she's heard me talk about this and read parts of it, and she often asks me, Dad, why does anyone want to do this job? And I, of course, respond to her, we need someone to do it, and I hope she will do it one day.
Well, good. Keep bringing her along. Now, this is a study of the presidency through key figures at especially important junctures in our national history. And the book is divided into two sections, Rise, which covers George Washington, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and then Fall, Ronald Reagan, JFK, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, with mentions of other presidents along the way. So talk a little bit about choosing those key figures who are so interesting.
Sure. Well, I chose figures, first of all, Susan, as you said, who I thought would be interesting and revealing for readers. It's impossible to write about the entire history of the presidency in one book, but I wanted to capture some of the key dynamics and some of the key figures. But there are two other reasons why I chose those figures. Many of them have enduring influence on the office today, sometimes in contradictory ways. And second, these are figures that in most cases were quite talented, had enormous, enormous capabilities, but yet they had many, many difficulties. And that's part of the point, that this job is so impossible and becomes more and more impossible with every generation, that, as I say in the book, we often set ourselves up to fail, even when we have the most talented presidents, and we don't always have the most talented presidents.
And how much power do you think the individual person has to remake this office?
Well, I think there's a lot of power that the individual elected to office has to shape the priorities and to determine the way the office will function on a day-to-day basis. That said, however, as I show, there's so many pressures on presidents, and again, as the United States has grown into a larger and larger society with more and more global influence, it's become more difficult for presidents to set their own agenda. Quite often, presidents lose control of their agenda even before they take office. That certainly happened with President Obama.
Now, one of the things I particularly enjoyed about this book was the way you talk about the importance of presidential rhetoric and how distinctive styles were from man to man. Lincoln's hunt for the right words, the way he didn't use abstractions, and how one speech, like the Gettysburg Address, could change a national historical narrative.
Absolutely. One of the ways presidents do shape public opinion and shape policy is by giving us not just words, but also a narrative, a way of understanding the world we're in. George Washington recognized this himself. Politics is a very complicated, dirty business, and in a democracy, we need a leader who helps us rise up from the dirt and helps us to see how things fit together and to have a narrative to understand the complexity around us. And Lincoln, of course, was the master of that. So was Franklin Roosevelt. And I argue that much of their success was their ability to use words, as you say, Susan, to really shape the way Americans thought about policy and reacted to their policy ideas.
In one of my favorite chapters, you talk about Saul Bellow and his description of everyone listening to Roosevelt on the radio, and then the way he viewed the inauguration of Herbert Hoover. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Yes, that's also one of my favorite parts of the book, Susan, so I'm really glad you liked that. Saul Bellow, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, is one of the great novelists of the 20th century. And Bellow was an immigrant, like so many of us, an immigrant from Russia, in fact, a Jewish immigrant from Russia. And he felt growing up in the Great Depression in Chicago that politicians were all dirty and corrupt and none of them cared about him. And he was largely correct. And he describes, as only a novelist could, how transformative it was for him as a young boy to be listening to Franklin Roosevelt on the radio. And as he describes it, this man with this funny accent from the East Coast who had no connection to him, from a very elite family Roosevelt came. Nonetheless, Bellow felt Roosevelt connected with him as no politician had before. And the irony, Bellow points out, is that Herbert Hoover's background was more similar to Bellow's. Herbert Hoover was an orphan. But yet, Hoover, he felt, never connected. He thought Hoover looked like a tomato can salesman. And Roosevelt, this elite figure from New York, connected with him. And I think the connection for Bellow was about empathy. Roosevelt conveyed a sense that he didn't always experience what listeners experienced, but he empathized with them. He understood. He cared. Presidents need to care for citizens to follow them, and you can't fake that. You really can't.
And I'd love that idea of everyone listening to him on the radio, of course. You know, that kind of national unity around the radio.
Absolutely. It was a relatively new technology at the time, and it captured the imagination of listeners. I play a lot of Roosevelt's fireside chats for my students. And it's amazing how they can still get drawn in, even in this world of social media. You know, there's something different about radio and something different about Roosevelt's use of words from what we get today.
Mm-hmm. Now, these men also feed into contemporary notions of masculinity. You think of Teddy Roosevelt and the idea of the strenuous life. We, of course, in Louisiana, think of Roosevelt coming here to hunt and fish. We think of Clinton as a womanizer, Obama as the epitome of a cool and devoted husband and, you know, great dad. So I'm curious how you see that kind of echo effect in society.
It's a great question, Susan, and there is no doubt that the American vision of a presidential leader is hyper-masculine. It's, as you say, the energy, the physicality, the courageous use of words and use of body language, but more than anything else, there is a paternalistic element to the office. This goes back to what I try to describe with the founders and George Washington. They wanted a figure who would be a father for the country, someone who would help nurture unity and cooperation among the children of different states. So built into the office, for better or worse, are certain paternalistic assumptions that then get magnified when we become a global power and we're the warrior of the world, the peacemaker of the world. So combining those elements of military leadership and father figure activities, it creates a very strong masculine assumption in the office. And I think women running for president or women around the presidency face a real uphill battle because of that.
Well, it was so interesting to me when you talked about Clinton and Obama as fatherless sons. And I think of them as fathers of daughters. You know what I mean?
Yes, that's a great point. And I think, as I try to argue, the absence of fathers in their lives is something which I think changed them and made them, in a sense, more attuned to female citizens, to their daughters, and to becoming fathers of a different sort. They were not the hard-nosed, pushy fathers that Theodore Roosevelt was, for example. These were much more nurturing fathers, or at least that's the image that they conveyed. I think that made them very attractive to female voters. And, of course, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton did very well with female voters. It made it very difficult for them to appeal to traditional Southern male voters. And I think therein lies, again, the way in which masculinity and femininity cross with the presidency.
Well, you've had a lot of time to think about this because you're married to an Austin City Councilwoman.
Yes.
And I wonder if you felt this gave you added empathy for these men and what they gain and lose by serving in public office.
Absolutely. My wife, as a city council person, is confronted every day, just in Austin alone, with a range of issues that are dizzying. She comes home and talks to me about these issues, and no human being could master all these issues. And then you think about that multiplied many times over if we're talking about a senator or a president, or for that matter, a CEO or a university president. And so one of the things I've learned following my wife and others closely is indeed how difficult the job is and how time is the most precious commodity. And most leaders do not have enough time to learn as much as they need to learn to make intelligent decisions about the decisions before them. That's a real challenge for democratic decision making. If you can't be informed, how can you make good decisions?
Now, one of the thrusts of this book is that it's as if all these presidents have been leading us to the president we have now. And I'm very curious to know if you feel hopeful about the office and its future.
I am hopeful. I'll tell you, Susan, there are two reasons why I'm hopeful. One is every day I get the great privilege of teaching large numbers of undergraduates at our university. And I know they're not fully representative of the public, but they're reasonably representative. We're a large public university, and, you know, they're better than ever before. We can make all sorts of criticisms of their having, you know, too many screens, too many phones, but these are young people who know the world is a dangerous, precarious place, and they want to make a difference. So I think we have enormous talent. No society has as much talent and potential leadership as ours does. And I hope my book shows that the changes in the presidency are changes made by people in the office and around the office. And I do think the problems of the office now are daunting, but I also think we have the opportunity to change the office. I wrote this book because I think we need to do more than just argue over whether we like the person in office or not. We have to talk about how we want to change the office so the office can be made more effective for our society and more effective for a new generation of leaders.
Now, you said something marvelous on your website about your professional goals, that we should research with monkish rigor as we write and lecture with novelistic flair. And that is such a happy note for readers. So, and you do that. I mean, it's wonderful.
Well, thank you. That's the highest praise anyone could give a writer. One of the reasons I'm drawn to the study of history is because history is a serious, rigorous science, but it is also an art. And great history, the history I love, is written in a way that is almost novelistic. There's no greater story than the story of the human experience. And I feel privileged to have the opportunity to try to tell that story. And I try to do it, and I've written this book, not just for my historian colleagues, but I hope for all citizens who care about the presidency. I think we need to really think deeply about this office today. And we have to do more than just argue over whether we like the present holder of the office or not. We need to think deeply about what kind of office we have had and what we want it to be in the future.
So much to think about. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with historian Jeremy Suri, author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. You can meet him Tuesday, September 12th at 6 at the National World War II Museum. Reception begins at 5. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Susan, thank you for having me on.
Shannon Svetanovich is Director of Educational Services for the YMCA of New Orleans, which makes her one of the busiest literacy activists in town. So it's a pleasure to welcome her back to The Reading Life to talk about National Literacy Month, which is all of September. Shannon, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
So tell us again how you got into this line of work and how you persevere.
Well, it will be 10 years in October.
Wow.
I came into this work because, number one, I love reading, and I cannot imagine a life without reading, quite simply. I'm so grateful to relatives who gave me books as a child. I can remember an aunt who gave me a copy of Little House on the Prairie that set me off on years of exploration of frontier life. And as a child, I was so fascinated by it. And books like that and so many others have enriched me. And when I think about how many people in New Orleans do not have the ability to sit down and enjoy a novel, they cannot read a ballot, they cannot read to their grandchildren, and they don't have the reading skills to succeed at work. I just think we as a community have to get together to do something about that. So for the past 10 years, my job at the YMCA has been to welcome people who come in and say, I want better for me. I want to learn to read, or I want to improve my reading skills. And our job is to say, we can help you with that.
That's a great job. So tell me, what are the numbers now for literacy in New Orleans?
Well, we're thinking that about 26% of our population here are functionally illiterate, meaning lacking the basic reading skills to fill out job applications completely without error, to read medical information. That's an issue we see with our students. I had one of my students come in with an inhaler that she was given by her doctor, and she handed us the instructions and she just said, I don't know how to use this. And so our job is to help our students in cases like that when they come in with documentation such as after Katrina. Mm-hmm. Insurance information that they couldn't read. Our job was to assist with that. Illiteracy for us means you lack the skills that you need to function, to hold down a job, and really to be your children's teachers. I mean, how many of us got a love of reading on the lap of a parent or a grandparent? And when I see students who walk into the classroom and their sole motivation is, I want to read to my grandchildren. We had a grandmother who walked in one day with a little picture book, and she said, all I want to do is read this to my grandbaby. That's it. So we do have a high level of illiteracy in the city. However, it is not hopeless. You know, it can be changed.
I bet that grandmother didn't stop with that picture book once she got that one down.
She did not. I mean, children are a great motivator.
They are.
To push you along. I would say when students come to us, the number one reason they come to us is to get a better job. But number two is I want to help my child with schoolwork. Parents come to us with textbooks and say, this is what my child is working on. Can you help me explain it to him or her?
Wow.
And so we are very happy to be partnered with New Orleans Public Library, to be located at the New Orleans East Branch and the main branch, and to be able to welcome people and say, whatever help you need, we want to try to accommodate you. The challenge we face is we have so many people who need our help. We usually do have a waiting list. We try to get through it pretty quickly. But, you know, we do use volunteers in the community. We try to do all that we can to accommodate those who come to us who want to improve themselves.
And what's the process? Once you get them through the door and once they make that commitment and get past that moment, so what is the process like for them?
Well, the next thing that has to happen is we want to test them. And test is the word no one likes to hear. But we always tell people, you know, we just want to see where you are today. We're not going to worry about when you dropped out of school, how much you knew in the past. Let's focus on what your reading and math levels are like today. So we give them an extensive test to determine what they know and what we need to build on. And then we have classes available at Maine and in New Orleans East at different times of the day. And the adults can come to us at times that work with their schedule. I mean, what we need to understand about adult learners is that they are busy. These are parents. These are people who are working and often working two jobs just to try to make ends meet. A lot of our students are in public transportation and need extra time to get around on the bus. So we offer very flexible hours where if you need to come a few hours on a Monday, then a few hours on a Thursday, whatever works with your schedule. From there, our teachers work with the students individually and in small groups to give them the math and the reading that they need. You know, some people come in, beginning readers, we call them, not knowing much beyond the alphabet. That's going to take longer, you know, to help them make some progress. We've had others, though. We had a gentleman who came in who had been incarcerated for 20 years, and he wanted to get his high school diploma now that he was out of prison. His reading level was great. It was just his writing skills needed a little polish. So he only stayed with us for a few months. He got his high school diploma, and now he's working and earning a living and, you know, doing what he wants to do, which is support himself and make a new life after, you know, paying his debt to society. The important thing, Susan, for us is to respect each adult where they are. Now, we have some adults who come to us and say, I'm here to get a high school diploma. I want to move on to community college. I need to get some kind of training for a better job. That's fine. And we have others who say, I just want to read more with my kids. I just want to be able to read the newspaper. Because I think that our adults do the best job of telling us what they need. It's really not for me to say. So when you talk about the process, when people to come into our program, what we need to know is, what are your goals? What do you want to do? And unfortunately, for a lot of our students, they haven't even imagined life beyond a high school diploma. So it's really exciting when we tell a student, you did so well getting your high school diploma. Have you thought about going to college? It's something that has never occurred to them. Maybe no one in their family went to college. So we're very happy we're able to lead them on that path.
So what's special about September and National Literacy Month? What do you hope to do that month?
Well, what we do in September, it is really our month when we reach out to the community to let them know, number one, that the YMCA of Greater New Orleans is here to assist, you know, adults who need help with reading, help navigating job searches, and to call on the public to, I always call them my refrigerator brigade. I say, put my business card or my phone number on your refrigerator. And if anyone ever mentions to you, I have a niece who needs a high school diploma, I know someone at work who wants to move up but is too afraid to take the math test, they think they're going to fail, go to your refrigerator, look for my number, and call us, and let us connect with that person. We have to be able to depend on the public to refer people to us. And I think it's important to know, you know, the YMCA can only handle so many people, but we are part of a larger network of adult education programs in the city and in the region. So I always tell people, if you're moving, let's say, to Lake Charles and you want to get a high school diploma there, call me anyway, because I will tell you where to go to get that high school diploma. We are all about sharing information. So September is about letting the public know we are here. Please share our information with people who need us. And also, it's inviting them to come and take part in events that we have later on in the year, such as in November, we have our Corporate Cup 5K road race on November 11th at City Park, where all proceeds will benefit our adult literacy program. And that's a great fun run in the park. You can run, you can walk, you can push a baby stroller, and it all benefits our program. So September is really our month to do outreach and let people know this problem will not go away unless we all join together and do something about it. I really believe our city is made weaker when we have so many who are not educated as they could be. Really, I believe it puts people's lives at risk. You know, we've seen that with our students who can't access health information easily. You know, it really is putting our students, our neighborhoods, and our city at risk when we don't do everything that we can do to educate people, and particularly people who are coming to us and saying, I want
need
this,
help. Yes.
Who are asking for it. So why can't we say, yes, we're ready for you? Like I said, we usually do have a waiting list, but we try to move through that as quickly as we can. And again, we're part of a broader network of other partners who do adult education as well. So we're always happy to do referrals.
Oh, Shannon, every time I see you, I know I'm talking to somebody who's changing the world for the better.
We're trying, Susan. No. Well, honestly, it's our teachers and our volunteers. And really, it's our students who I think are the real heroes, because they're the ones who get up the courage to come to us. And I know what they're facing. You know, like I said, adults are busy. They have jobs. They have families to take care of. And it's easy to put education to the side. So when they make time for us, I feel like we have to respect that and do all we can to move them through as quickly as we can.
Well, it's great work. We've been talking with Shannon Svetanovich, who's the Director of Educational Services for the YMCA. Don't forget the Corporate Cup, November 11th in City Park, and visit the website at ymcaneworleans.org for more information. Shannon, thanks for all you do.
Oh, thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Jeremy Suri, discusses the impossible presidency, the rise and fall of America's highest office. Tuesday, September 12th at 6 at the National World War II Museum. Reception begins at 5. Ronnie Vergitz discusses and signs Saints and Lesser Souls, the New Orleans views of Ronnie Vergitz, Tuesday, September 12th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Antenna, in collaboration with stationer Nancy Sharon Collins, presents the next in the Letters Read series, Regrets, an evening of live reading celebrating the written form of human rejection. That's Wednesday, September 13th at 6:30 at Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Regrets is emceed by co-artistic director of Goat in the Road Productions, Chris Kamenstein, and accompanied by guitarist Rob Hudak. Letters include crushing job rejections, bombastic resignations, the letter from that insatiably cute boy who inexplicably broke up with you in sixth grade, expressions of loss or grief, letters of apology, of remorse, received, copied, never sent, notes left on windshields, nailed to trees, taped on doors, or snuck into bags. Darren Wang discusses and signs his novel, The Hidden Light of Northern Fires, Thursday, September 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Room 220 presents the launch of Ecotone, a book of art and poetry by Benjamin Morris and Myrtle von Damitz, Thursday, September 14th at 7 at Antenna Gallery on St. Cloud Avenue. Children's book authors Dalt Wonk, author of The Laughing Lady, Bob Bruce and David Cuthbert, authors of the new Cinderella Battistella, and Cornell Landry, author of Goodnight Nola, discuss and sign their books Thursday, September 14th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses The Narrow Road to the Deep North by Richard Flanagan, Saturday, September 16th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Robert Beatty reads from and signs his young adult novel, Serafina and the Splintered Heart, Saturday, September 16th at 2 at Octavia Books. When the Southern Independent Booksellers Association meets here September 12th through 15th, one of the highlights is Read NOLA, which takes place Sunday, September 17th from noon to 6 at the Sheraton, New Orleans. It features authors Christine Baker Klein and Jocelyn Jackson in conversation, along with 17 other authors. Tickets are available at SIBA, S-I-B-A, web.site, S-I-T-E, -ym.com. Former Governor and Congressman Buddy Romer discusses and signs Scopina, his book about his early years, Tuesday, September 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. Christopher Kelly discusses and signs America Invaded, a state-by-state guide to fighting on American soil, Tuesday, September 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Patty Friedman discusses and signs Unorganized Panic, a novel, Thursday, September 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival's annual writing contests are now open. And this year, they've added a new category in flash fiction. Here are the categories and deadlines. Short stories of up to 1,000 words are due November 8th. One-act plays no longer than an hour, November 1st. 2 to 4 poems with a combined length of up to 400 lines, November 15th. And fiction up to 7,000 words is due November 30th. For more information, visit TennesseeWilliams.net/contest. The Fall 2017 New Orleans Writers Workshop semester begins September 18th. The New Orleans Writers Workshop, a community writing program taught by trained published authors, is offering courses of varied lengths, 9-week, 4-week, 2-day, and 1-day, at locations around the city, including NOCA, Antenna, the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, the New Orleans Museum of Art, and the Rosa Keller Library. All skill levels are welcome. Visit NewOrleansWriters.com to register. And the New Orleans Book Festival will take place Saturday, November 11th in City Park. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at TheReadingLife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.